Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today is a special show because I will be starting off the show with an interview with legendary Chicago musician Larry Blazingane, who I guess I didn't even ask you. You now go by a different name, right?
Larry Abdul Hakim.
Which would you prefer that I call you during the interview?
I'm still being called by both names.
I'll just call you Larry.
Yes. Thank you.
But legendary in the sense that you played on a large number of recordings in Chicago and just so important in the history of Chicago music. And so we'll be going through your career and talking about all the recordings that you were involved with and playing a lot of the music you were involved with.
Okay.
So thanks so much for coming up and telling your story.
Okay, you're welcome.
So, first of all, are you originally from Chicago?
Yes, born in Fayette.
What part of Chicago are you from?
West Side.
What area specifically?
Douglas. I was born over in the Douglas Park area.
What streets?
On Douglas Boulevard, where I was born, but I was raised on Springfield, in the 1600 block, 18th in Springfield, all the way up to my... Until I was about 20 years old, 21, just right when I met Betty Jean Plummer.
And how did you get involved with music initially?
Well, when I was 7 years old, I got hit by a car going to school to get some Crayolas for school. And I had a compound skull fracture. And, you know, after that ordeal in the hospital, the doctor said that I needed therapy once I had got out. He was telling my parents. So my mother asked the doctor, what about music and guitar? And he said, yes, that was okay. And so she started teaching me how to play guitar. I didn't even know she could play.
So your mom actually knew how to play guitar?
Yes,
She started teaching you guitar as therapy for your accident?
Yes.
And you were just 7 years old?
Mm-hmm.
So what was she teaching you?
Well, she taught me how to play the blues. She taught me how to play, like, with the bar and the way that she did, like, what they call, like, the Delta blues. She was from Arkansas, and I didn't know it. Also, my grand uncles and grandfather, they were musicians, so she had access to instruments. She also played piano and some harmonica. But she taught me how to play the blues, the real blues.
That's awesome.
Yeah, yes.
What year was that?
I was 77 years old.
Late 50s.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And had any of your relatives recorded? You mentioned that you had a musical family.
Well, my father sung with a group called the Silver Stars. That's right, the Silver Stars. And they were on the radios at the time, you know, in the 40s, I think that was. And the group was well enough where Sam Cooke, my sister told me Sam Cooke would come over to the house to my father's rehearsal because her and Sam Cooke went to school together.
Oh, that's cool.
Yes, uh-huh.
So you started playing guitar when you were just 7 years old.
Yeah, that was the beginning of it. And I went through a neighbor who had influence on my life, Richard Barnett. He was teasing me about that I played the same song for about a year. and afterwards, you know, when I got the age of 10, I got with a group. I can't remember their name. It was a doo-wop group. And I performed with them on a show with Bobby Rush at the time. Bobby Rush lived on Lundell, on 18th and Lundell. And when that was my first live show. And the Vernon, the Mandels, he lived down the street also. He had an influence with me also.
Vernon Hammonds.
Yes.
He was older than you.
Yes, uh-huh. He had a great influence. He used to teach me and show me, invite me over to his house all the time once he had saw me practicing on the back porch.
And he played guitar too, right?
Yeah, he liked that. Everyone used to be crazy about Curtis Mayfield, and he was like a carbon copy of Curtis at that time. And he was the first one to teach me how to play like Curtis Mayfield.
Okay, that's cool.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So you said that you did a show, you said, with some doo-wop group that you don't remember.
I can't remember their
name. And Bobby Rush.
Bobby Rush was the star of the show, and they were added an attraction. And I was 10 years old. They were all like 17, 18 years old, 19.
Okay.
And
And then you, so did you, when did you end up having your own group?
Oh, right after that, I formed a group called the Four Dukes.
Okay. So who were the Four Dukes?
Well, obviously myself, Clarence Thomas, Glenn Fox, and Donald Hernandez.
And what kind of shows did the Four Dukes do?
We were doing shows for Christmas shows for George Collins, alderman who ended up being in Congress, and we were playing at Northwestern, most of the colleges, and Mayor Daley for a lot of his events that he would have. They would ask us to do, and for a lot of and Christmas shows off. At the Sherman House, we had a thing. We played there for about two or three seasons every year for this organization, for orphans. Let me get that straight. And Al Johnson, he over the Teens with Talent at the YMCA. That's how we got discovered. There were the Conquistadors. Part of them lived down the street. Robert Hill and Irvin. He lived down around the corner also. And so. They saw us. I was influenced by them, really, man, because I used to see them practicing on their porch. And they had us to come up to the YMCA, Teens with Talent, and we met the Baby Miracles. And Al Johnson put us together because we were so young. You know, we were like, 11. I was 11 years old, and the drummer, Peanut, that was John Fox, Glenn, he was about 9 years old, and no one had never seen anyone like that before. You know, we were on most of our television news, almost all the news stations and all the major newspapers at that time.
So you were just kids, and you were a band of four guys.
Yes.
So what kind of stuff did you play as like just kids?
Ooh, believe it or not, T for Two.
Okay.
Hideaway by Freddie King. Some stuff that that I would compose, invent and compose that was accepted by Al Johnson, and.
So you were like a jazz blues combo kind of.
We were a blues, R&B, but we also from Bobby Neely, the drummer, had us playing some standard stuff, that we had learned from him.
Okay, and you talked about doing Teens with Talent, which was Al Johnson shows.
Yes.
And I know what that is because we had talked about it a little bit when I had the Conquistadors up in here. Can you talk about what that was?
You mean the Teens with Talent?
Yeah, what was Teens with Talent?
Oh, it was a place where, Teens with Talent, we joined, joined the organization, our parents, had us to join. And it was a place where we met every Saturday where we rehearsed. Al Johnson had a space at the Y where we all were assigned rooms to rehearse. And he would coach us. And once we got to accepted, where he was pleased, he would start booking us at the colleges and shows in various places. At that time, we also performed in McCormick Place. Like with the, we would open a show for the Artistics at that age as the Baby Milkers and the Four Dukes. At that time.
And where was the YMCA that you were
on? Kesey and Arthurton, I believe.
So every Saturday you went and practiced at the Y?
Yes, we all met, all the groups. There was a lot of groups there that practiced there.
And you were like so not only were you your own combo, but you were the Baby Miracles backing band.
Yes, uh-huh.
How you were together for a while as your own combo before you became the Baby Miracles backing band?
Yeah, they had us as a separate situation, and someone that suggested that we would be put with the Baby Miracles. We were all the same age. They were there before us, and when we came on the scene, that it seemed like that was the icing on the cake to have the band same age also,
Okay. Because the Conquistadors were also, who were the main band there, they were also like a self-contained band.
Yeah, they were saying, we had different acts, Al called them, Act 4, that was the Conquistadors. We were Act 3, and they had Act 2, Act 1. Sometimes we would be at places like the Trianon Ballroom, I think that's what it was, and they have these various stages. It might be a stage here, and at the college, stage 1, stage 2, 3, and 4, and they would have us spread it all over the hall, call these different acts, and we would perform like that in concert at that time.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know that. They never explained that to me because they had a They had a record label called Act 4.
Yeah, that's how that came
they
about.
They never explained what the name was, yeah, so that, that's interesting. So so you said that you became the band for the – and the shows that you did for the Teens with Talent, what kinds of shows were they? Were they like – you said you did shows for the mayor at that point?
Well, we would – Al Johnson would have us, and Jimmy Hudson also helped us. We would – wherever the mayor might be speaking or some kind of political thing, you know, most – a lot of those gigs and for the orphanage and at the Uptown Theater for Zemeda and them, we would do these shows, like for the Christmas show for over in Lundell given by George Collins. And our precinct captain, I forget his name, Mr. Cunningham, they would get us to do these shows for the community. It was mostly political, like events. But we would get all of those gigs. By Al Johnson, he was a public relations man for Bell.
Okay.
Telephone. And he had access to all these different avenues here in the city.
So how old were you at that point when you were doing this?
11, 12, 13, cause I started recording. I wasn't a part of the Conquistador, but I was performing with them. I was the youngest thing to see with them, you know.
Okay. And did you get paid as part
of? Yes, we got paid. We would get paid. That's my first paying gig. I started when I was 11 years old, and that was at the Teens with Talent. When I was 10, that was like a free show. But when we got over to Teens with Talent, we started making money.
How much?
$10 a person. I was the oldest one. No, Donald was about a year older than me. I was 11. He was 12. Clarence was 10, junior man. And Peanut, he was about 9 years old. And we would get $10 a piece. That was the beginning.
That's pretty cool, though.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So then you started doing shows with the Baby Miracles.
Mm-hmm.
So what was their deal? Did they do all Miracles type songs?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. And they were so often to the Miracles, or Baby Miracles, like when the Miracles were here at the Regal, well, we could go to the Regal for free to see them as their guests. We didn't have to pay.
So the Miracles knew about the Baby Miracles.
Yes, uh-huh. Smokey Farnes took Matlin one time on took with him. I think it was over to England with him after Matlin had, you know, grown.
Okay.
Yeah, uh-huh. And stuff, and like Marv Toplin. We all knew each other from then. After I grew up and ended up later on in life, I was working with Jackie Wilson and ran. We were on shows with the Miracles, and Marv Toplin, he was the guitar with Smokey and them, but he would like to hang out. As young as we were, he would prefer to hang out with us because he remembered us from when we were like 11 and 12 years old.
Like he had mentored you.
Yes, right, okay. Which he did, because I learned how to play Tracks of My Tears from him directly.
Okay, that's cool.
Yes.
So, do you remember what year you joined the Baby Miracles?
I think that was in 64, I remember my card. I think it was 63, 64.
So when the Baby Miracles did shows, did they only do miracle songs?
Yes, uh-huh. Madeline and Arthur were the lead singers, and they were doing, you know, Mickey's Monkey, I Like It Like That, That's What Love Is Made Of, or You Can Depend On Me. That was one of the favorite.
Do you remember the lineup of the group?
Well, Madeline, only with the female, and her youngest cousin, Arthur, he was the next lead singer, and there was her brother, Glenn. His name was Glenn also.
And what was their last names?
Okay, Matlin Strickland and Glenn Strickland, sister and brother. And Arthur and I can't think of his brother's name, McThune, or Johnny McThune. Arthur and Johnny McThune and Jerry. I'm not sure. I can't think of Jerry's name. I can almost see it, but it's Jerry. They were all related.
And I had on here on my show earlier, I think she was one of the original leads of the group that left to be in the Ivory's Marilyn McThune Cookie.
Yes. Uh-huh.
She said she had like a growth spurt and had to leave because she wasn't a baby anymore.
No, nowhere near a baby. she. That was Cookie was Arthur and Johnny's sister, oldest sister.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, but was she the lead before
I don't know. There, she was there. When I came there, she had been replaced, but she was there all the time. And, you know, we was there. She was a part of the family situation. She was sometimes rehearsed with us and all of that time. But Jerry, took her place. Because, see, Cookie had grown. She was way bigger than her. If you have to see this, you know.
Okay.
And stuff. And we used to tease her about that. She was sometimes getting disputes about teasing her all the time about how tall she was, you know.
So then she eventually left because it didn't make sense.
Well, she was around. She did. She just got started in another group, which one of the singers with her played saxophone. I forget her name. Carol played saxophone with us for a while. She played alto. Not only did she sing, she played sax. She was going to Marshall. We got quite a few. My trombone player who played with us with Larry and the Hippies, he came from Marshall also.
Okay.
And she performed with
us. Carol came up here for that interview too.
Yes. Uh-huh.
So the Baby Miracles were together. So you're saying they were like two sets of siblings pretty much?
Yeah, uh-huh. They were all, it was sister and brother, and all the rest of them were cousins.
Okay.
Johnny and Arthur were brothers, and Jerry was a cousin.
Okay.
To all of them. And Cookie, they were all relatives.
So they ended up, they were together for how long, and they ended up actually getting a recording contract?
The young folk.
So why did they end up changing their name to the Young Folk?
Because we were given that name by Jimmy Jones at Wonderful Records once we had signed the contracts.
So how'd you end up getting a contract?
Well, Chuck Nolan, who became part of Larry and the Hippies, he was playing with Mighty Joe Young, and we were performing with him at a club, which Barnett Thornton, Matlin's father, who became a great MC here in Chicago, it got us the show, and he was impressed. But he didn't know we had already played behind Hal Barrage between then. Hal Barrage was so amazed when we were like 15 years old, and he was amazed. He said, "Man, y'all all play my grown musicians." And we performed with him. So we went there, and so happened Jimmy Jones. I knew Jimmy Jones from the YMCA.
Okay.
When I saw him, and he used to give me pointers on the guitar and stuff, and he took me under his wings, and then we kind of got separated. And when we saw him and he saw us, that's all it took. We were, you know, automatically accepted.
So what year did you sign with Wonderful Records?
I can't remember exactly. I was 15 years old because I was 15 because I ended up 15. I was 15. Yeah, we were 15. Mountain was 16. I was 15 years old.
So what was it, like 66, something like
that? Something like that, uh-huh.
So
66, 65, 66, something like that.
So you had been with the Young Folk for a few years, I mean, the Baby Miracles for a few years.
Yeah, uh-huh, we were that up to the age of about 14 years old.
And then what was the story? I'm sorry, I didn't totally follow. Someone saw you at a club, and then...
Yeah, the saxophone player that was playing with Mighty Joe Young, named Chuck Nolan, he worked at Wonderful Records.
Okay.
He was doing most of all the horn workers, you know, at that time there, and plus he worked there on the staff, and he had us to come to Wonderful Records. And
okay.
And when we saw Jimmy Jones there, it just fell all in place
because
everybody
because he knew you already.
We already knew. He knew all of us, the Miracle Baby Miracles.
Had you ever tried to get a record contract before? No.
We were, you know, that was the last thing on our mind.
Okay.
We were just enjoying, you know.
You were just some kids.
Yeah, kids.
And so whose idea was it to come up with the name The Young Folk?
Jimmy Jones. Jimmy Jones' name.
Just because you couldn't be the Baby Miracles, that was another group's name.
Yeah, that, but it ended up, The Young Folks turned out to be someone else's name also. And we had, you know.
Okay, well, we've been talking for a while. Let me play the record and we could talk some more.
Okay.
So this is The Young Folk with the first record they released. This track is called Joey.
Yeah.
Okay, that was just the Young Folk with Joey, and that was the group that, essentially the same group as the Baby Miracles. It was pretty much the same lineup, right?
Mm-hmm, the exact same lineup, the Baby Miracles and the Four Dukes.
And so you actually, the Four Dukes are the band playing on the record.
Uh-huh.
And plus there's some additional session musicians from Wonderful Records.
Yeah, it was more, we had a saxophone player named Tyrone Hines who played the baritone. We all at school, he was at Marshall, he was about 17 years old or 16. And that's the only added musician at that time. We were also called the Red Registers. A lot of people didn't know that. They put us with Alvin Cash.
So all the records that say Alvin Cash and the Registers is your band?
Yeah, no, what we did, the Charge, that was us. We even went traveled with him, did shows off of that. We were Larry Hippie in the Register, but then they started pushing us toward the Larry and the Hippies. Alvin's got a brand new bag, that was us.
Okay, yeah, I didn't know. I always thought for some reason Andre Williams had something to do with this stuff.
No, Andre did the Twine Town. The rest of the stuff was Jimmy Jones and Eddie Silvers and Otis Hayes.
So all the stuff that says the Registers is your band.
Yeah, well, the Registers, Jimmy, them, they gave the Registers the Philly Freeze. That was out before us in Alvin's Boogaloo. We came in after that, but they had put us with Alvin as the Registers.
Okay.
For him, the band. We were Larry and the Hippies, but we start with him. They put us with as the Registers with his brothers. And the brothers were called the Crawlers.
Okay.
But they eventually became the Little Steps.
Okay.
The famous dancers. And so that's how they came up with the name the Registers. And when we came in there, as the Young Folks, we met Alvin Cash. And so he took us, because his brothers were the same age as we were. So we all joined together, but that was another scene.
Okay.
You see us with his brothers, the Crawlers, and George, who played the drums sometimes. He played with we just had a production, a self-contained production with Alvin. It was nice.
By self-contained production, you mean you did shows?
Self-contained, yeah. Wherever Alvin, they started booking us as an act, Matlin. That we weren't the Young Folks no more. Madeline had become Miss Madeline by herself with a record called Behave Yourself.
Okay, so let's talk about that. So first of all, the record I just played, it's an excellent record. Did it get play in Chicago?
Yes, it got played here in Chicago and some other places. And my parents had heard it. Yeah, it was out in California, I believe, also, because it was Joey Bishop had made a remark about it, the record being about him. And but there was another group. It was out there because it was another group called the Young Folk, and they had to pull our record because they were already called the Young Folk. I even saw them one time on television.
Okay, yeah, I don't know about any other Young folks, so yeah, maybe.
Uh-huh.
But so you're saying that so they had to change the name.
Yeah, and that's when Madeline became Miss Madeline. We became Larry and the Hippies.
Did the group break up, or they just sang behind her?
The group. Madeline, they took Madeline and she became a solo artist, Eddie Silvers, and there was no more Young Folks, the background. The only background Madeline had was, believe it or not, was Carl Davis, Gary Jackson, who wrote Higher and Higher, and Floyd Smith was doing the background.
Okay, so on that record, Behave Yourself, there is a backing group.
That's who did the backing.
So you're saying it's not the Young Folk on backing.
No.
So who is it? Floyd Smith?
Gary Jackson and Carl Davis, believe it or not.
So Carl Davis actually sings on the record.
Uh-huh, with doing the background. They did the background. Eddie Silvers had them to do the background.
Who's Gary Jackson?
He wrote Higher and Higher, played guitar with a group called the Constellations.
Okay, I know the Constellations.
Yeah,
uh-huh. Okay, that's cool. I didn't know. So it's actually not the Young Folk. Do you know what happened to the rest of the guys that just stopped singing?
They just went their different way, you know. But Madeline's father and my father, Madeline's father started traveling with us. He ended up being, one of the top comedians, Barnett Thornton. A lot of people had been around that. It was like Carl Wright and Barnett. But it was like Larry and the Hippies and Madeline. That's the way they was. Booking us as that way, and we went on that way for a long time until with Alvin Cash and Reggie. Like we were shuffled back and forth, but we eventually stuck to Larry and the Hippies because they had put out a single on us. Larry and the Hippies had the record. We was known mostly a lot of times as the Registers, and sometimes Larry and the Hippies.
Okay, so. Lonely Girl came out and, sorry, Joey came out.
Mm-hmm.
And did the Young Folk ever tour or perform?
We did some shows and stuff. It was so complicated at that time. We were doing things because there were so many. And I used to hear Anne Dukanje, she would kind of grumble, you know, about that she had to, like, chaperone us because we were, you know, all young.
Were you all at Marshall High School?
Oh, we were spread out from Manly, Westinghouse, various.
Okay.
Marshall, you know.
So the record came out, and then how long before you had to change your name?
Well, when we came out with Larry and Hills, give me some of yours, and I'll give you some of mine's. We came. Are you talking about from the Young Folk?
From the Young Folk.
That came out when Eddie decided to put a record out on Matlin. They had interest in Matlin.
Okay, so they didn't want the Young Folk, and the Young Folk already they couldn't use the name because another group had the same name.
Yeah, that and that was part of it. But that they were the way they were. They would have could have came about and did another name, but they were interested in Matlin because Matlin was amazing, you know, because she was young, and she was already small, petite like that, and to see her with her, such a strong voice. And they took a special interest in Matlin.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, let me play the follow-up record because it's really good, and then we can talk some more. Our band.
We still were doing laying the tracks, doing it.
Okay, so this is Miss Madeline, and the backing you're saying is not the Young Folk.
No.
And you're saying the rest of the Young Folk just went back to school and did their own thing.
Uh-huh.
And this track is called Behave Yourself. Okay, so that was just the second record that Marvelous Records released on Miss Madeline after the Young Folk, and they released it on her as a solo artist with just some random backing singers that were not the Young Folk, and that was an excellent record called Behave Yourself. So did that record get any play?
It got some play. How much I don't know. Well, you know, like when I was young. But I know it did get some play because we did some work off on that.
And you were saying that after that, that stuff started happening, you became actually session musicians at Wonderful Records.
Yeah, uh-huh. Around about at that same time, a lot of people, you know, once when we did Joey, George Lena was so pleased, and Otis and Jimmy, they had us recording everything. The Salem Travelers, Willie Parker, Otis Clay, Josephine Taylor, and some other stuff. A lot of original Day.
So when you were still in high school at that time.
Yeah.
And you were working at Wonderful.
Yeah, at Wonderful, coming to school from Western House, I walked in the studio, because when we get out of school, we always meet up at the studio, because, you know, if they had something to be done, we would get that work. So happened they had this young group performing, Eddie Silvers. And believe it or not, it was the Jackson 5. They were recording. I'm a big boy now. And the way things were, by me being on the staff there, I was asked to show Jermaine how to keep his bass from sounding booming. And Eddie Silvers asked me, did I have my guitar? And he said, grab a guitar. I want you to play this other part with them. But that's how things was happening. And then we were like, if I was there, I was performing. If I was in that studio, I was performing.
So can we talk about that now that you brought that up?
Yeah.
So Big Boy, was that recorded at the Wonderful Studio?
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
Where was the Wonderful Studio?
1827, I think. 1827, on Michigan. 1827, I think that's what the address was, 1827. Wonderful Records and United Record Distributors was downstairs. Also Tottenham Town, that was Ernie, George Lena's brother.
And I knew that Eddie Silvers had written the record,
uh-huh.
But it's the Wonderful Musicians playing it. It's not the Jackson.
Oh, it's the Jackson 5 playing.
They're playing it.
Uh-huh, plus me, uh-huh. So yeah, their cousin's playing the drums, or he is.
So Johnny is the drummer.
Their cousin, the one who passed not too long ago, he was playing. It was the Jackson 5, their family, plus their cousin was playing the drums. There was Jackie, Michael, Tito, and Jermaine.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And their cousin, I forget his name, he played the drums.
I think his name was Johnny.
Yeah, okay.
So you're playing guitar on the record?
Yes, uh-huh.
So at the beginning of the record, there's that do 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 do.
There's both of us playing. Tito. Is playing. I think I'm playing the chopper, one or two. I can't hardly remember, but I know that on the guitar, we had to split that up. He had me to come in and play the other part. I'm trying to remember what it was, the chop thing, or was that? Because they were already playing the song when I came into the studio practicing, but they couldn't get the sound together.
Okay.
And that's where I came in, to help them get the sound together.
Wow. Well, so I didn't realize I would even get a Jackson 5 story out of this.
Oh,
that's cool.
Yeah, uh-huh. So I already kind of knew them anyway, because we used to be around. We ended up doing shows together a lot of time and playing at places, the competition on the West Side. And the Jackson, you know, they played one night, we played the next night. Joe and my father were friends. When they went to Motown, Joe called my folks up and tried to get us to go with them to Motown, but we were under contract with Wonderful.
Okay.
So that's how that went.
So, do you remember who was working the boards at that session?
Otis Hayes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know he was an engineer, actually.
Yeah, he was the engineer. He took Russ's place.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then that became one of their hits too in Chicago.
Yeah, well, that was the first one. You know, people say that Diana Ross discovered them, but you know, it might have not been as big as the Motown, but that was their first record. I mean, that was. Man, you know.
Yeah.
Chicago and there.
That's cool. So while you were in school, you just went after school every day to the studio.
Uh-huh.
And you said that they called you, they came up with the name Larry and the Hippies.
Yes, uh-huh. They gave us that name because at that era, the Hippies.
Okay.
So we kind of, you know, we were saying, man, the Hippies, but we accepted it.
Okay. Were you like the band leader since they gave you the Larry and the...
Yeah, I'm the one who initiated the group and they pushed it. I didn't care about the leadership, but they put it that way, you know, because I was always leading the group, you know, put it, but I didn't want that front thing. I was shy all the time, you know.
Okay.
So I got started to get, you know, for me with the people, you know, I got a little older. That changed.
So you worked at Thailand Town, and you worked at Wonderful, and you played on a lot of sessions there. And then they finally released at Thailand Town, which was owned by the Leaners also. They released a record on you, and it was called Enough for Everybody, and Give Me Some of Yours, I'll Give You Some of Mine.
Yeah, I'll give you some of mine if you give me some of yours. That's the one that they was released first, and then they flipped it over to the other side.
What year was that released?
Oh, you got me on that one.
Was it like 69?
No, this was around about 67, 68.
And Thailand Town Records, that didn't exist at the same time as Marvelous, did it? It was the same owners, and they came out with that after?
What it was, Jimmy Jones, something happened there at Wonderful Records, and Jimmy took us with him, with our parents. We got our contract release, but we ended up recording at Ed Cody's, and Jimmy Jones was producing us, and he made a deal with Ernie Lena, George's brother, downstairs, and that's how that came about. Even Alvin Cash ended up on that label also.
So you're saying both labels kind of existed at the same time?
Yeah, all this stuff. Ernie was running the distribution, the record distributing section.
Okay.
And George was running the actual recording company, but they were two brothers, you know. They had the business in the whole building.
Okay, well, let me play the record and we can talk some more.
Okay, then.
So this is, you want me to, Give Me Some of Yours, and I'll Give You Some of Mine.
Yeah.
Okay, that was just Larry and the Hippies with the first record they released under their own name. That track was called Give Me Some of Yours, I'll Give You Some of Mine, and that came out, Larry was saying it came out around 1966 on Thailand Town Records. And do you remember, so on that record, up to that point, you had been like the session group at Wonderful Records, and we were talking about how there were four guys originally in the Four Dukes. Mm-hmm. So were there the same four guys in Larry and the Hippies?
We had a shift. The original Four Dukes was Donald Hernandez. He played congas, but he got replaced by Gus, who played the guitar. And we went all the way up until the disc record. That's Gus with us on the other guitar. And we had Tyrone Hines became part of the groups. But on this record particularly, Eddie Silvers did the solo and Larry Nestor played the organ. But then after we working with Alvin Cash, he had us traveling with him. And that's when we started using Larry and the Hippies all the time after that. Because we had Matlin. We became starting to get known with us in Matlin. And we were being, a lot of demand for us.
They had the public demand, and we started working at these different nightclubs and stuff.
The guys and the gals. We added two more horns, three more horns, and we became six. Larry and the Hippies. We kept the name, but we had grown. And with that, we started playing all of the regular main clubs here in Chicago. Even Percy Spann hired us for the house band for the club, which was the Club de Lisa. And then it changed its name to the Burning Spear. And then the Burning Spear went over to the High Chaparral. And the High Chaparral, we was the house band for them also before. I think we was the first band, a stable band that they had, and that was because of Larry Hippie. We was known as the Six P. We had the three horns and stuff.
What year did that start happening?
Oh, that started happening. We was with the Emotions when I was 16. About 16 years old. It is 16. I have to have them around about 67. I think it was.
So 67, 67. After this record came out, you added the extra people.
Uh huh.
So the record I just played, did it get play on the radio?
Yes.
Did certain DJs play it more?
Butterball, he played. He really liked it. He even spoke about how much he liked the record.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then
WVON.
Who were the horn players you added?
We had John Bright, Jack, who we call Jackie, and he played the trombone. And Chuck Nolan, who discovered us for Wonderful Records, he played the tenor sax. He became part of the group. He started, and we added him. And Tyrone had left, and we hired them. And then we had various trumpet players, Eba, Stanley White, and a few other people, Cleo Griffin, who was with the Young Ho Trio. And we did a lot with that name. We ended up with the Emotions. When they had out So I Can Love You, I was about 16 years old. We were with them for about a year and a half to 2 years.
And that was all through Perf Staples?
Uh-huh.
And he had you work in his clubs also?
Well, before he had the club, we were playing on tours. They were big.
So Larry and the Hippies were like the touring group for the Emotions.
And that's how we were introduced. It was another phenomenal thing because we were all the same age. We were playing the Apollo and touring all of it with the Impressions and Jerry Butler and all of that. We were doing all of the main tours and stuff. Then our Purvis ended up getting the Purvis house or something a little later.
And then didn't he later manage the Sons of Slum? That was
Took our place.
Okay.
Yeah, the Sons of Slum. Some of them was with us at the Sears YMCA, that group. And the piano player with the Sons, Tom Frank, he played with us first.
Okay.
With Larry and the Hippies, up the guys and gal, but he ended up getting with them. And we went further into the industry, and they replaced us.
Okay.
Uh-huh. We went with Jackie Wilson.
Okay, so you started, the first sort of major big group you toured with was the Emotions then. Is that right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
And so you were no longer the house band for Todlin Town. Todlin Town went out of business at that time.
Yeah, there was staff. We weren't nobody as staff. They ended up going out of business.
And the local clubs you played at, you left to do touring for a while.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And then one thing you did was you cut a record around, I think, 1970 with E. Rodney Jones.
Right. That was with Jerry, or Tom and Jerry, or the Boogaloo Man.
Yeah, and the record, the E. Rodney Jones record that I have on you, it was one side, it's got vocal with E. Rodney Jones. It's called Right On, Right On, Sex
yes.
Machine.
Yeah, right. That's
And the flip is a football. It's an instrumental.
Yeah, that, well, the Right On, Right On was supposed to be ours, but E. Rodney heard it, and he was very impressed and liked it. So made a deal with him. We didn't have no problem because we had an organization at that age with Jerry. He introduced us to do, especially me, about business. And we had a self-contained company. That's when I started getting off into the record. He gave me a break as an arranger and producer at that age, as a teenager. And that was my first production as a producer with Jerry. I was Right On, Right On, and E. Rodney Jones.
So you actually you produced the record, you're
saying?
Yeah,
I arranged and produced that for Jerry.
Okay, should I play the record? Did it get any play in Chicago?
Oh, yes, it did. Uh-huh.
So the Right On, Right On, it's got... So Jerry, E. Rodney Jones cut a few, like, rap-type records where he just does, like, a DJ rap.
Oh, yeah, so he always did that. Even after that, he had real nice one even after that.
Okay, well, this is the one. So you're saying you helped produce this record.
Yes.
And so this came out on Westbound Records out of Detroit, which, like, Funkadelic and the Detroit Emeralds were on.
Yeah.
Do you remember how you got a deal with Westbound Records?
Well, first of all, Jerry made the deal. I'm trying to remember the name that he was with this another fella. There was a new group called The Ideals. Jerry had it on one of his labels, and it got picked up by Westbound.
Yeah, the Ideals were on his label at the time.
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the label that it came out for, but it's because the record started selling, and it got picked up.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And,
okay, I think it came out on Jerry O Records.
Yeah, right, uh-huh.
Okay, well, let me play the record, and then we could talk some more.
Okay.
So this is E. Rodney Jones with Larry and the Hippies Band, and this is Right On, Right On.
Use your head. Right on.
Okay, that was just E. Rodney Jones with Larry and the Hippies Band with Right On, and that came out probably around, I think, 1970, something like that. Does that sound right?
Yeah, sometime around, just around the Emotions, before the Emotions, right around that time in the connection of with them. I think it came out at the time we were with the Emotions.
I think it came out around 1970.
Yes.
69, 70.
69. I know it was in the 60s because I hadn't met Jackie.
Okay, so how'd you get involved with Jackie Wilson?
Our manager was Tommy Dart.
And who was with the Ideals?
Well,
before?
With the Ideals, yeah. He was with Tom and Jerry. And
didn't he say, he told me he sang with you guys sometimes too?
Yeah, we did some shows with him on the fact because he was known of being with the Ideals.
How did he become the Hippies manager?
We met him with Jimmy through Jimmy Jones and Arthur Morton at the record shop called Soulville Record Shop. That was very popular at that time. And when he heard us, he got attached to us, and he was such a nice, lovable person. We call him String Bean, and he took us under his wings. Cause everything you never could see him by himself. You would always see us and him together, no matter what. Performing shows, hanging out together, and so Jackie needed a band, and so Tommy Dark was also Gene Chandler's personal manager. Him and Gus Redman. And so Tom was at Brunswick at the time, and Jackie needed a band, and so Carl Davis mentioned it. And that was how we met Jackie Wilson up at Brunswick, to meet him to perform, for him to perform at the High Chaparral. But we didn't, the rhythm section didn't play, but he used our horns, but we already became friends and knew him. And so Jackie had to go to Reno, and he asked for us again. And that time he took us all. And that was the beginning of that situation. Us, Cheryl Swope, them, that they had an outfit. And we went with Jackie to Lake Tahoe at Sahara's. And after we came back from that, Jackie told my father, he said, Pops, I'm taking your son. I'm taking him with me. And about 6 months or 3, 4, 5 months later, we got a phone call, and it was Jackie. And so the rhythm section, myself, Peanut, and a junior man who was Clarence, we still carried the name of Larry Hippies, but we started traveling with Jackie as his personal band. And that went on for a while and off and on. And then Jackie took me as a solo guitar player and accompanist and ended up being his band director. And with that, but anyway, that didn't last for a while because I started getting interested in some other things in the studio. I guess that's how I met Clarence Johnson.
So what years were you with Jackie Wilson and as his band director?
Oh, I started directing for Jackie in 72 then. When he came back and got us, he pulled me. He just grabbed me, you know. So I put me in charge of things, and next thing I know, he was calling me his band director and his accompanist.
Like his touring band director.
Yes, everywhere. He didn't even have to come to rehearsal. My job, I knew him so well, and I had all, you know, and stuff. I was put in charge of his music.
So were you on his records also?
Well, I was on one album that came out after his heart attack on an SRO called Jackie Wilson Live that they played. It was on VON. I happened to hear it myself with Richard Begeet, and I was playing it. That's the only one that
Because it was a live album, and yes, your band played live. With
well, them. It was me. It was me, myself, directing and conducting, directing. I was doing stuff with directing for Jackie on television with Dick Clark, Wolfman Jack, and all of that. I became his main man. We were more than just client and employee, you know.
Okay.
Yeah.
You were saying you'd hang out with him all the time?
Yeah, we were like relatives and stuff. His folks, his mother, his daughters and cousins, my mother and sister, all. It was like a one big family situation.
But you also worked at Brunswick with other artists there too, right?
Yeah, the Artistics. I came at that's one thing. Yeah, with the Artistics, I direct for them. They kind of at that time I started directing for a lot of groups. Let me see, Barbara Acklin, sometimes Walter Jackson, Major Lanz,
Billy Butler.
So what do you mean by directing? Were you, like, just for their live shows?
Yeah, for their live shows, uh-huh.
Okay,
for their
so
live show. They would hire my band with me for specifically for that, because I had got groomed and trained for that at the club, the Burning Spirit, through Perry Span. Because every act that came to Chicago that he brought here, our band played behind him. It was the band. That's what Perry Span had hired us to do.
So what did it mean that you directed? Like, they would go on tours, and your band would play all the tours?
Uh-huh, and I would direct the band, the charts and all of that stuff, because I knew music. I was more than just a guitarist. I would actually direct, conduct. I knew how to conduct.
So
I played guitar and conduct.
So had you gone to school for that, or you just picked it up?
I picked it up mainly from Eddie Silvers. I eventually went to school. I was raised, brought up like the Red Saunders Orchestra, Al Duncan's. They took us and started teaching us at a young age. I was around very popular musicians.
And can you explain why you had to redo the charts? Because they already had recorded the stuff in the studio and had charts, but did you have to rearrange them?
Sometimes we would have to condense the chart. They would have a big orchestra, and we would condense it. I would condense it. Some of Jackie's stuff I actually rearranged for him for his live shows, because it was too large for some of our shows.
Okay.
And stuff. And he didn't, like I said, with them, like with the Artistics and stuff, I had already knew them, and so they called me for the same reason, to come put their band, like Otis Clay called. He said, Larry, I need some direction.
Okay.
And that's what they were calling me on, because I had become very well groomed in the industry. Very well groomed.
So you not only directed and rearranged the charts, but then you would come up and actually play on the live shows.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
So did the Hippies have a stable membership at that time, or did you have people
come
in?
Yeah, our rhythm section was the stable situation. We had the horns of the six went quite a while, but it ended up with the rhythm section. Myself, Peanut, and Junior, which Clans, we were like the nucleus. That's how we started off, and we ended up that way. And until I started venturing off as a for myself as a producer and composer, and I was wanted by a lot of other producers for my musicianship.
Okay. But the horns, different people came in and out of the horns.
Yeah, but basically we kept the same until we didn't. We mostly kept the same, but just about the same situation with the horns, all the way until the last time with Jackie Wilson. We had one, the original trombone player, John Bright. He was with us to the end, until we didn't use any horns, until I was demanded by Jackie to become a solo person with him, to direct his music for him. Bill Robinson, Jimmy Smith, and Sonny Forrester, and they were all older than me. But for some reason, I was with Jackie to the end.
Okay.
He called me back, and I was with him to the very end.
Okay, and then so at Brunswick, you were never a session musician at Brunswick. Like, you didn't play on the records really at Brunswick Records.
No, I did demos. I played on the Brunswick thing, on Alvin Cash's Ollie Shuffle and some other things. I don't know if they came out, but the Ollie Shuffle.
Yeah, that record came out. But
yeah. Uh-huh.
So, but you were a member of an actual Brunswick group, right?
Right. That was on the compositional skill.
So what was the Brunswick group you were a member of?
Channel 3.
What's the story with that? How did you become a member of that group?
Oh, well, I had been playing with Emmett Garner's group, the Trans. And so they had went their separate ways, and Jerry Jerome met Bobby Thomas. But I already knew Mitch because of Tommy Dark. We all used to hang out together. So we got together one time, and everybody started recommending each other, because they all knew each other, the Artistics and Trends and any group here, they all knew each other and stuff. So they were always helping each other. And I was recommended because of my situation in the music to get with them. And
so you already knew the Trends, you're saying?
Yeah, we were working with them, the Trends, as Larry and the Hippies.
You're saying Larry and the Hippies backed the Trans shows and stuff? Okay.
Uh-huh. With the horns and everything, the cool six pieces, called Tommy Dark.
So you're saying Jerome pulled you in?
Emmett Garner.
Emmett of the Trans.
And Jerome, by him, that was another thing. I mean, see, at that time, we was, it was all like family, that's why it was so strong. The entertainment at that time here in Chicago was
it was family. Everybody knew each other, and we just dealt with each other like family, you know.
So they formed a group, and you were their official guitarist.
Uh-huh. A guitarist, composer, everything. I had all of these songs and stuff, and these themes and stuff. And so they would come in and complete and put some more lyrics to them. We had a catalog that got picked up at Brunswick.
But they only recorded two songs.
No, they recorded more than that. That's what came out.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
So the rest was just in the can.
Yeah, they came. We never did finish because Brunswick, some things happening there at Brunswick, you know, I don't care to really talk about too much that was happening in there in their business and stuff that was kind of depressing for some of the acts. But I ended up going across the street working with Clarence Johnson, with Lucky Cordell and E. Rodney Jones, and Sebon Foster had a organization called GEC Production, and which they had produced I Got a Love Jones on
Brighter Side of Darkness.
And so they had an album to complete because their record was selling so well. And I was mentioned to Clarence now, to Mr. Foster from Ruth Moore. Uh-huh. And she recommended me and stuff. Me and Byron was up for the same job, and I got the job for supervising and everything. So I was called in to complete the album for the Love Jones album.
So yes, because I noticed your name is on the record.
Uh-huh.
So you're saying that you got called in to complete the Brighter Side of Darkness record?
Yeah, I did. All the rhythm arrangements was done by me, and I composed three of the songs. Me said Vince Willis was with us, and Tom Tom, he did all the strings and horns. My job was to lay all rhythms.
But Love Jones was already done before you got
yes,
to
uh-huh.
it. But they needed someone to finish the album.
For the album.
So you did some of the tracks on the album.
I did the whole rest of the album because that was the only song that I didn't do. It was I've Got to Love Jones.
So you did, what are some of the songs you did?
Ooh, Baby, Give Me Just a Little Bit, I Owe You Love with Vince. That was Vince's song, but I supervised all rhythms and arrangements and stuff.
And how did you know Ruth Moore?
Oh, because some of the groups that she had knew me because from all the way back to the Four Dukes.
Okay.
You know, like
she was West Side and you were West Side.
Yeah, uh-huh, right. She had the Five Wages and a whole bunch of other groups, the Kittens and Silk.
Okay.
And stuff. Yeah, uh-huh.
And then you ended up doing a lot of production and writing for Clarence Johnson after that.
Yes, uh-huh, yeah.
So I can play some of your productions then. One artist you produced and worked a lot for was Betty Jean Plummer.
Oh, yes.
Can you talk about who she was?
Well, Betty was, I didn't know at the time, but she was one of Mr. Foster's personal artists. And so I was assigned to her. And she came, we met, and she brought her material in. And when I saw that she could play the piano so well and at her age, and this voice she had, oh, her voice was amazing. She was amazing. And we worked so well together and stuff. I was appointed as co-producer. And I did the arrangements, tracked the same situation, me and Tom Tom. Me and Tom Tom, we were doing quite a bit of the major work here in Chicago at that time and stuff. For a fact, my band was good. They had a... You know, I don't know. It's not to be too much proud about it, but it was happening. Like Satterfield, them and Larry Fraser, and some of the names, all the cats at that time, they would do the track, but it didn't match up to my track. They would call me in, I would come in, and my tracks would be the one. So I started getting most of all of the rhythms thing. I was known for this rhythm thing. So I would use three guitars, maybe four, two basses, several keyboards. I was getting to that thing like Motown and Philadelphia sound.
So you're saying you helped kind of make the Chicago sound?
Well, at that time, at that period, I started a thing where a lot of people weren't doing what I was doing.
Okay.
At that time.
So you're saying like you would, like behind actually the boards in the studio, you would do multi-track?
Yeah, Fred Bradbury up at Chess Studio, we became friends. I learned a lot, but I got started at Wonderful Records in the studio going there. I was familiar. But Fred Bradbury at Chess, and he was also at another place where Donny Hathaway recorded. But Fred broke me in, would always let me get with the board and help him, assist him in the mixing. So I started learning about the consoles and everything. And mix, I would do my own mixes. I came with the sound. They started putting me in charge. They just gave me room once they saw what I could do. Plans, you know, brought me all up into there in Lucky Cordell.
So you're saying in addition to doing, like, playing on sessions, you did engineering and production.
Yes, I would do my remixes myself.
Okay.
I had learned and stuff. See, a lot of that, on the creativity, that was my job. I was the supervisor. I ran all the music stuff that went on. They're picking musicians or something. If they brought someone in, they had to come through my situation in order to get anything done. Even Vince Willis, that's how we met.
Okay, well, let's play one of the tracks you did on Bettie Jean Plummer.
Yes.
So I think this is one of the tracks that you did that she got some play on. This is Baby, I Want You Back. This got some play in Chicago, right?
Yeah, even but that came in after. That was me and Benjamin Wright who did the arrangements on that.
So this is so she did two records on Bell, and then this one came out on Salem, which is
right.
C-Bons Foster's label.
Uh-huh.
You're saying this one is her last record?
Yeah, that came out after
after the Bell records.
I remember you. Yeah, after the Bell.
Okay, well, let me play this one, and then we could talk more.
Okay.
So this is Bettie Jean Plummer with Baby, I Want You Back.
Thank you.
Okay, you're tuned to WHBK 88.5 FM in Chicago. That was just Betty Jean Plummer with Baby I Want You Back, and that was produced and mixed and engineered by Larry Blazingane, who was up in here telling his story. And Larry was telling me that that was just, they were all the Betty Jean Plummer records were, that were released, were all done in the same session. Is that right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And there were two other 45s released on the Bell record label earlier than that, but they were all recorded at the same time.
Yeah, it was the Bell was a two-sided. They played one side and flipped it over to the other side. They were both unique, you know.
And then they released one more record on Bell.
Uh-huh.
And then you were telling me before that she's the same person as Jean Plum on High Records.
Yes, uh-huh. That's where she went after that company had folded.
Which one of those records got the most play in Chicago? Do you know which one of her records?
I really don't know, because I had one back with Jackie Wilson on that road. There was a lot of stuff happening to me at that time, because there was Pat and Pam that was out. Was out. The Lintons was out. All of this was happening.
Okay.
And plus I was with Jackie. Byron, he was with Ramsey Lewis. Benjamin, he was with the Dales. And then we were all, it was all this type of stuff was happening at one time.
So which Linton's record did you do?
I can't even remember the name of that song. I know it was on the Carissa label. And George Clinton wrote it.
Okay.
He sent the tape. And I arranged the rhythm for that. And Tom did the strings and horns.
Okay. And then you did a record... You actually released a record on your own label by Kenya Collins, is that right?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So what's the story with that?
Well, on that label, we had GSC had folded at that time, and me, Clarence, and Byron Gregory, and Benjamin, we went to Chess, not to Chess Records, but to the Chess building and rented out there. Top floor, I think the ninth floor of the penthouse, and open up our own offices and stuff. But it was coached and supervised by Clarence Johnson, so he advised us and helped us to start our own label. Byron started Carissa Records, and I did the Forever Records label. And me and Byron, our office was together. We were partners, because he played guitar and I played guitar, and we were best of friends. And Clarence assigned me Kenya.
Okay. And who was Kenya Collins?
Kenya Collins, I had known her from earlier days in playing the nightclubs. I think she was Mel Collins' wife, first wife, or whatever.
Yeah, because wasn't he married to Joe Armstead also?
Yeah, Mel Collins, if you know Kenya Collins, Mel Collins, and Joe and stuff. Yeah, they were all together.
So he had different wives at different
times.
Yeah,
there's a lot of stuff. I can't give no exact details about it, but I remember that much. And I already knew of Kenya prior to that. But anyway, so I was assigned to her and Byron. And that was the one that they chose to be the single side. It was my label, but Clarence was in. He was supervising us because we were young, new into the business end, but he was schooling us at the same time. There was a group called North, East, South, and West.
North, South, East,
yeah,
West.
Right.
I had them up in here, actually. They were Ruth Moore's grandkids.
Right. Uh-huh. It made me think about them. That made it pretty well into the in the charts, Billboard also. Compare them to the Jackson 5. It was funny the way they mentioned it by something, by candiness or something. But anyway, it was an... It was okay, you know.
Okay, well, let me play the record you released. So this is on your own label. Did you finance this record yourself?
No, that's what I'm saying. Clarence was the go-getter.
Okay.
Make the deals with the people, like I said, he's supervisor. And we were all connected together, like I said. I ran Forever Records. Byron ran Carissa. And Clarence had his. But Clarence was like an umbrella over all of us. This was something he was giving, breaking us into the industry and coaching us.
He was just giving it to you to run the label.
No, these were our labels and stuff. But he was showing us how to do it. He would, he would, He recorded the artists and put them with us on our label so that we could make money to keep us from getting lost after GEC had folded. So this was his way of thanking, helping us and thanking me, Byron, Benjamin Wright, and you know, this is, so he was doing us a favor. He was doing us a real good favor. He was introducing us to the business and the money that he made the deals. And we would split this money. We had meetings and stuff, and money would go to this section, and money go to this section.
Okay, well, let me play this record. This is the Kenya Collins record. This is called If She Only Knew.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that was just the one record that Larry Blasingame released on his own record label. That was Kenya Collins. How do you say your name correctly?
Kenya.
Kenya Collins with If She Only Knew, and that got released on the Forever record label probably around 1975, something like that, I think.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And that is very obscure. I don't think it got any play or ever really came out.
Right.
But ultimately you did a lot of productions, like writing and mixing and arranging and producing for Clarence and a lot of stuff for 20th Century Records, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
So a lot of artists you were telling me before, they actually brought in from other cities?
Yeah, uh-huh, from other cities, Kansas, L.A., Russ Regan, he was the president of 20th Century. He was pleased with it. He was sending his artists here to Chicago for us to record.
What were some of the artists they brought in from other cities?
Well, I remember there was Chuck Walker, and there was another, I can't remember his name. It was various people, but this is one, he had a record out called The Horse, I think it was.
Well, Cliff Nobles had a horse record.
Not The Horse, Chloe. There wasn't Cliff Nobles. It's another dude. He has something like The Horse. I cannot think of his name. Chuck Walker, I remember him.
Where was Chuck from?
He was from Kansas. And I remember they used to come here, and they would put him up in the hotel. And he for some reason, people always get attached to us. I mean, because we were young. And it's the same deal. I was assigned him, and there you go. Once we get the stuff together, I go in the studio and record them. And that was I really liked this one because that's when I met this fellow named Jerry Long from Motown Records. He did Smiling Faces, Keep On Trucking, and we became very close friends. And we did a joint arrangement, and it was such a pleasure doing that with him. I don't know what became, how much airplay was done, but this was a nice production, very nice production.
Undivided Man you're talking about.
Yes,
And so how long, that was through like about 75, the deal with 20th Century where you were producing for them?
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff. Like I said, we did a lot of stuff at 20th Century. I can't remember all of it because we were doing, Clarence and them were doing so much stuff at that time, artists, and Russ Regan would send various people. Like, I can't remember all of their names. Jose Wilson, he was the promotion man. He used to come here and just hang out.
Okay.
With us. They had Barry White. Barry White was their only group, and there was another group, a young group out there.
Okay. So how long did you... So in the mid-70s, did you stop doing the production?
In the mid-70s?
Yeah. Like, what made you stop doing the production work?
The production, I ended up going with Jackie, but I was still involved with him, but it was mainly with Jack. When Jackie had his heart attack, his stroke, I was very disappointed and depressed about his situation. I really didn't want to work no more after that with Jackie. So there was a break in my career there. I went back to school and eventually get my degree, and I did some more work. I worked with Jerry Long out in L.A. Doing jingles with him and some more people. And they continue working with the Artistics and the other artists, Barbara Acton, you know, those types of groups that I had. But it was after Jackie had his heart attack, stroke. It wasn't the music business wasn't the same for me.
Okay. Okay, so you went back to school, and did you still play music today?
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
So in the 80s, like, mainly you were in school, and did you play music in the 80s?
Yes. I was doing a lot of your local stuff, and sometime I would go on the road and stuff. I toured. I went with Steel Johnson, a lot of the regular cats, you know, because I had established myself
okay, so
in the business, and everyone knew me. You know, if I was wanted to, you know, available, I would work with various artists.
Okay.
Because I not only play guitar, I had Jerry Long. After I met him, he had such influence on me. He introduced me to arranging, orchestration, and that added another dimension to my career.
So you did orchestration in...
I was doing that with Jackie Wilson, because Jerry had introduced me to arranging.
What did you arrange?
I was arranging Jackie's live shows, music, live shows for him.
But after he passed in the 80s and stuff,
I did regular shows, but, you know, they were nothing to really to holler about and stuff. I really, you know, I was concentrating on myself. I had become a Muslim, and I was concentrating on myself, you know, my spiritual side.
Okay.
And a lot of people, I continued working with the Artistics, Barbara Acklin, Willie Henderson, and stuff. Even Alvin Cash. I went back at Brunswick. I was out there. I ended up at Brunswick. I forgot about that. When Carl Davis had left Brunswick, but when Jackie had his heart attack, before that, his manager had set up that I could go always, you know, still go to Brunswick.
We're pretty much out of time. I'm sorry.
Oh.
But, so, first of all, thanks so much for coming on down and telling your story.
My pleasure.
You have so much story because you're involved with so much music in Chicago. And I appreciate you coming down and talking about all this stuff. There's no way we could get through everything that you've done.
Yeah.
So do you have any last words for the listening audience?
Let me see. to look forward to hearing some new production with myself and William Bell on Alan Kirk. It's a blues, but it's new. We are almost finished with it, and also a production between myself and William Bilal. We're in production right now as we speak.
Okay, well, people should look out for that.
Yes.